The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
Hey, this is part two of Partially Examined Life, episode 139 on Bell Hooks with our guest Maisha Cherry. Last time we kind of were trying to just lay out her overall view. I was thinking in this half we can be a little more systematic and try to go through the portions of the two books that we took on, The Ain't I a Woman and Black Looks, and say what we have to say.
Yeah, I wonder what people have to say about her use of Angela Davis in the Black Women and Feminism chapter. And it seems as if she was saying, or at least her narrative of the Angela Davis situation, was that Angela Davis didn't have the kind of group that she's encouraging we all should have. And I mean, this goes back to the kind of the love thing. So when a woman decides to be radical, it's very important that they have this group. And she also suggests that the feminist Michelle Wallace also didn't have this sense of care, and not having that care can lead people when they get older to not be as radical as they once were. I don't know if you all had that same reading, but I was just trying to see. In some ways, I kind of disagreed with her account of Angela Davis, but I wonder if her main point was to show that loving, even if one becomes radical, having a group that could support you and love you is important in the struggle. I'm not too sure if that's a correct reading or not.
Hmm. She brings it up in both places, right? In the Making Ourselves Revolutionary Black Women chapter, and then you're saying she's in the Black Women and Feminism chapter as well of Ain't I a Woman, I
believe. Yeah, the fifth chapter, yeah.
Right. I'm not totally remembering the details of the reference in Ain't I a Woman. I know in the other one, she's very explicit about, yeah, I mean, in that positive chapter, the Revolutionary Black Women thing, she does say that it's all too easy. She's critical of women, whether in stories or real life, who they escape some struggle. Maybe there's a particular instance of domination. You know, they're in an abusive relationship and they escape that. But then they end up pursuing something more traditional than bell hooks would like. Mm. That they have not tied the struggle to an overall historical liberation experience. And so it doesn't have the follow through. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. This having a community that supports actually self-actualization and not just having everyone trying to bat you back into the same hole that you escaped from, or, you know, at least a similar one, or having internalized these limitations, that these are all things that having a social group to help you out would be good.
Yeah, I guess the part that I, in some ways, I was disagreeing with was kind of like, well, how did bell hooks know that she doesn't have a social group in which she can support, right?
So I thought the point she was trying to make about Angela Davis was that even though what happened is after Davis achieved a certain amount of recognition and success, she was put in this role of being exceptional. So in other words, it was like the system came down to frame her as somebody who didn't have peers and couldn't be active in a group in the way that you're talking about. And so even though she may not have put herself in that role where she was trying to separate herself from other people, that the media or some, you know, the forces of ideology put her in that role, so that it's a way of continually marginalizing. Even when somebody's successful and achieves a level of subjectivity, you know, her own subjectivity against the dominant paradigm, it's a way to continue the marginalization. That's how I read that. So it wasn't so much a critique of her, a critique of Angela Davis, but more a recognition of what happened to her.
Can I read the quote? It's a page 183 in Ain't I a Woman. Although Angela Davis became a female heroine of the 60s movement, she was admired not for her political commitment to the Communist Party, not for any of her brilliant analyses of capitalism and racial imperialism, but for her beauty, for her devotion to black men. The American public was not willing to see the political Angela Davis. Instead, they made of her a poster pinup. In general, black people did not approve of her communism and refused to take it seriously.
She says it a little differently on page 55. In Black Looks. Mm-hmm. The Davis autobiography was written. She was 30 years old. Her most militant expression of subjectivity erupted in her 20s, made into a cultural icon, a gesture that was not in line with her insistence on the importance of collectivity and fellowship. She came to be represented in mass media as an exceptional black woman. That's in quotes. Her experience was not seen as a model young black women could learn from. Most parents pointed to the prison sentence she served as reason enough for black women not to follow in her footsteps. She was isolated. She was projected as an isolated figure. She did not have the galvanizing impact on black females that she could have had. I read that not as a criticism of Davis and her actions, but as the way she was portrayed, unless she's criticizing her for not somehow overcoming that.
Okay.
But I think there's other things in that section of black looks that are exactly what you were talking about, Aisha.
Okay. I couldn't find the exact space in which I felt, you know, kind of a unease.
What is your unease? I'm sorry.
I was just this assumption, it seemed, that Angela Davis lacked community or the love that we were referring to.
That she wasn't loved herself or that she...
No, I wouldn't say that. Just lacked community.
Lacked community.
And I just, yeah, to provide that care and that love.
You had asked that about, well, can't you turn that on Bell Hooks herself? And I think just in seeing her speak, some of the things she has to say in Black Looks in particular, you had mentioned her autobiographical, you know, how this is a recurring thing in her. And so she talks in a few of these places about the consciousness raising sessions that she went to and really just how being in a community of women who are trying to figure this stuff out was very essential for making her what she was. And I guess, and for keeping the fire going, the way she talks about it, that like when somebody, that writing is just a solitary activity. And when somebody comes up to her and says, "But your writing changed my life," that is the community that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, what's important is it may not be the case that these historical figures that she mentioned, such as, I mean, they're historical because they're still alive, Michelle Wallace and Angela Davis, even if they weren't part of a particular group, or a particular famous feminist group, I don't know, doesn't necessarily mean that they lacked that kind of community. And I think that was just kind of what I felt after reading it. So, of course, it was known that Angela Davis was part of the Communist Party, but that's not even mentioned as a group in which she could provide a sense of care. Maybe she decided not to mention this group because what she was really going for was a feminist kind of group, or a group of women. And so I was just trying to figure out what group is important or needed to help a black woman self-actualize. And if the communist group is excluded, then it makes me all the more interested in what kind of group she thinks is needed.
Well, it seemed to be your view that you don't really need a group at all, right?
I don't think you need a particular group.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be the case that as opposed to having a consciousness-raising group of 30 black feminist women, I could have, I mean, just to use the case of Angela Davis, I can have a communist group that consists of black women and also black men, perhaps, who are aware of patriarchy and all that other stuff. I mean, perhaps that group can also provide for me of what I need. And even if I don't have these strictly theoretical groups to help me, perhaps, you know, family. So it's more the type of group that I was more concerned with than anything.
What's the function for bell hooks of this kind of connection? Is it that it acts as a kind of sounding board? I mean, I don't want to sound glib about it, but is part of it effectively therapeutic that you are able to go through and work through this activity of self-actualization and decolonization by participating in it with people, maybe to first order, that you can have group with? Or is it something that's really a question of support and intellectual and emotional, but having a home? Because thinking doing this kind of work is just lonely, like being a writer and by yourself is just lonely. Those would seem like two different kinds of things.
Well, I think it seems like the group connection, again, stress the having a connection to the historical movement of liberation. That doesn't
That's
even
different.
Sound like a group. Yeah, again, a group of people who are alive. Just thinking about the Stoic that we read recently, that, you know, I like the fellowship of one of these dead philosophers better than any of these boring people that I run into. And
that makes it sound like a musician who says you need to know the classics and really sit down and learn all the old stuff in order to be a musician, kind of thing. Is that what that means?
Well, not the classics, because the classics would be the hegemonic,
okay,
the something from a foreign culture. But you need to have models of enlightenment. Whether or not these people were fully enlightened, you need to learn from their insights and their mistakes, perhaps, and their observations on each other. You need to be part of that historical dialogue. So hopefully that involves being in the room with other people or on the internet with other people, having some actual real live dialogue. But it's got to be supplemented by the other stuff too, the historical connection. I mean, she talks about in this Revolutionary Black Women section, really how the monolithic paradigm of female black experience this black feminist essentialism that she's seen in these groups. So she talks about a group that she attends, which is being very therapeutic for many of its members because the different women are getting up and they're telling their personal stories about being messed up by being in unsupportive environments. And so she says, hey, you know, actually, I was raised in a pretty supportive environment in terms of it was segregated. And the black community that she was in the South, they were pretty supportive of each other. Not that they were without problems. She talks about her father and stuff in different places, but she's not sharing this experience that is being voiced. And the fact that that was a different narrative than what was being expressed at this meeting, then she was scolded for this. She was kind of shouted down, like as if she was trying to erase another black woman's pain, is what she says, by bringing up a different experience. This competing narrative, one that was seen as trying to divert attention from the true telling of black female experience. That's page 44. So in that sense, I would think that kind of thing would be endemic to just a group. That groups are sort of inherently try to develop these norms that get imposed on one another. So you'd have to have a very specific enlightened group of very enlightened people for it to fulfill the vision that she has for a group here, one that perhaps does not exist.
I thought that that was really an extension of this idea that there has to be a single narrative for the group in order for there to be some kind of progress or narrative, that when you're oppressed, it's almost as though you have to agree to a single narrative, because if you're allowed to have a view that there are complexities and variances in people's experiences, it might open the door to people saying, oh, well, you know, not everybody's like that. In other words, devalues. I got the impression she was saying that the other black women were afraid that somebody who didn't share their narrative would devalue their own narrative. And does that make sense?
How does devalue cash out?
It cashes out in that if you say a class of people all has the same experience, then you can use that to anchor some kind of a, both individuals can use that to anchor their identity, but also you can use it for political action. But if you have a class of people, at least in our ideology-driven society, where we say, oh, well, half of them, you know, have had terrible experiences and half of them haven't, then that's a justification for blaming the half who have had the bad experience. Like, well, why didn't you, you know, these other people didn't have a problem. Why do you have a problem? Or it takes the teeth out of political action if the narrative isn't consistent. And one of the things she's trying to argue for is that there has to be diversity and there has to be your ability to express your authentic voice in a safe place where there can be this free exchange and acknowledgement of individual variance, and while at the same time recognizing each individual's and authenticating each individual's experience, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah. And, you know, her issue with what she calls black feminist essentialism. And then the very next statement of that, she says it would not allow for difference. And it seems this notion of difference seems to be kind of a theme in black feminism, particularly early black feminism. I mean, when I think about the work of Audre Lorde, which she takes some time out to cite often, but I don't think she referenced Audre Lorde's thinking about difference. Audre Lorde was a huge believer in, you know, in difference, right? That black women and white women come together. And that she doesn't use bell hooks language of trying to get rid of the monolithic framework, but she wants to suggest that the fact that we have different experiences, that adds to the movement as opposed to taking away from it. And it seems as if bell hooks seems to be in line with that, that difference is not, shouldn't be a divider, but it adds or contributes to the movement as opposed to taking away from it.
Yeah, and she, bell hooks, is pretty critical of the notion that you would sort of internally, politically regulate a difference within the movement based upon sort of political ends. It seemed to be her reading of why you would dismiss certain kinds of feminists as not being the right kind of feminist, or bringing up the wrong kind of topics or having differences, is that it would dull the edge of the activism to have diversity of opinion within the group. And, well, she's just opposed to it in general. She disagrees that it makes it weaker.
A recurrent theme I see here is the difference between what you might describe as just philosophical theorizing in a public setting and political speech. That, so we had the earlier example of, you know, is it okay to say, I know I'm a white guy, but I'm oppressed by the situation too. Well, so we said bell hooks both thinks that that's true, but thinks that any given instance of somebody saying that is probably serving their opportunistic self-interest to divert attention away from people who their problems are much worse. And so it's the kind of the same thing is going on here.
Well, not just that their problems are much worse, Mark. Isn't it that it's a way of negating the criticism? I mean, wouldn't it really be an act implicit act of oppression, right?
Right. So that's exactly what was going on here, that in this meeting, she was just saying something about, hey, you know, I actually don't share that problem that you had. And the people in this group were saying, by just expressing that now, that's an aggressive act. You're negating what I just said. I just find this very difficult to make this division. And that's what makes me, again, coming back to this, if we see the practical upshot of a lot of what Bell Hooks is advising us is that we have to be very careful about messaging, then what we're saying is that you can't just say the truth as you feel like you need to say it at any given time. You need to be engaging in political action whenever you speak publicly. You need to be addressing the things that most need addressing. So whether or not what you're saying is true for your experience or not, if it's not conveying the right message, right? The way she puts it is, this is just again, in one of the things that I saw her talking on YouTube about, I think, was people criticize political correctness. But what political correctness is just being aware of who is listening when you're talking. It's actually thinking before you speak, thinking about who your audience is. But if you're engaging in personal psychoanalysis, which I think is partly what you do whenever you're thinking deeply, if you're engaged in a discussion with other people, say on a podcast, and trying to think through issues that are difficult to think about, then you have your own agenda in doing it. You're trying to figure out something so that you can yourself become more enlightened, psychologically improve yourself, whatever. So that requires the exact kind of safe space that I don't think is really compatible with speaking to all possible audiences. In other words, you say something because you feel like you need to say it, because that's kind of where you're at the time. But at least according to this thing that sometimes I think Bell Hooks is arguing against, and sometimes I think she's supporting, if that's not addressing the group narrative appropriately, then you can't do that. That's not being properly respectful of who might be listening. Am I being too vague here?
No, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that she views all our relations as deeply political, that we're deeply political animals.
Yes, and yet can't seem to see in this particular circumstance how these women that were objecting to her voicing what she was doing at the time, why they would object to it. And I think they're objecting it for the same reason that we've outlined elsewhere. Whenever you're saying something that sort of has a kind of messaging that's unhelpful. I don't know, maybe this is just a leap in comparison here.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a different situation and compare it to the one that Hooks is specifically referring to in this example. So one of the criticisms that she brings about with the early 20th century white women's movement and only making their agenda be that of issues of white women, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is totally different. Like, so in that way, it's like we're excluding a group of people and their concerns, and we're focusing very selfishly on our own kind of promotion at the expense of Black women. But in this particular situation, what is problematic for her, and I'm just going to read it. She says, my story was reduced to a competing narrative, one that was seen as trying to divert attention from the quote unquote true telling of Black female experience. So these are all Black women. In this gathering, Black female identity was made synonymous again and again with victimization. The Black female voice that was deemed quote unquote authentic was the voice in pain. Only the sound of hurting could be heard. No narrative of resistance was voiced and respected in this setting. I came away wondering why it was these Black women could only feel bonded to each other if our narratives echoed only if they were telling the same story of shared pain and victimization. So I wonder in this way, it's speaking of a different kind of difference that Audre Lorde is referring to in the first case about as far as Black women and white women. But these are Black women trying to, I guess, in some way bond. And it seems like that bonding is being cut off because one does not share similar kind of experience or identity with the other women. And I wonder if this is a way of her kind of criticizing, going back to the monolithic kind of notion of what happens when you get among groups of one same race and gender, what kind of some of the problems that can rise as a result of that. And it seems to be sensitivity to telling one particular story. And one tells an opposing story, what unfortunately comes about as a result of that.
Something that Bell Hooks refers to, I can't remember where, I think it's toward the beginning of In I, a Woman, when she's talking about these consciousness-raising groups, she says, at first they had a doctrine where nobody could criticize anything else anybody said. Because we're trying to deal with a system where our voices have been silenced for so long, just let me say what I need to say and don't give any crap about it. But they found that that kind of precluded progress. That precluded actual discussion.
Well, that isn't a discussion, right? Because the discussion would involve critique in the way that she's using it. I mean, that's, yeah.
Right. So she sees why somebody would want to do what this group she's criticizing is, why they'd want to be sort of monolithic in. I know this is not exactly the same situation, but it's a similar motivation. It's how can we best, this is an actual problem here, is if the historical issue and the personal psychological issue of a lot of the people involved is we're trying to find, as individuals, our voice, and it's been stamped out. I've never sort of been allowed to think radically before, and so now I'm in a group. I finally hear somebody echoing the pain of my experience that I've never really been able to voice before. How best to facilitate the healing that brings about? Bell Hooks thinks that we are strong enough that you can still get that kind of healing and yet acknowledge difference. And in fact, that's what love is, not having read her books on love, but knowing that she liked Erich Fromm and we read him recently. So I can say that it's, you know, letting others be what they are, be themselves. And that is perfectly in line with just everything she has to say about self-actualization. And so, yes, of course you should treat other people, listen with respect to their stories about themselves, and you don't have to agree with them or have shared the same thing in order for that to be a supportive social group.
I also wonder, at what point did Bell Hooks raise her narrative? So if it came immediately after someone kind of expressed their pain, their childhood pain, and then she says, well, I didn't have that experience. My background was so supportive. I mean, so if it was that way, I can see how someone would respond, right? So I think even in recognizing difference, there is still a way in which one, there's rules to this, right? There's a way in which one expressed that difference and that kind of setting.
It's also a function of when there's group pressure to have a dominant narrative, that's again reflective of absorbing and internalizing and functioning inside of this oppressive system, because the system functions by assigning characteristics and opportunities to groups of people for the purpose of marginalizing or empowering them. And I think she feels like that dynamic, overcoming that dynamic, is part of the process of this decolonization, recognizing that you can have open discussion and simultaneously maintain the integrity of a, you know, the fear of differing narratives is a fear that is put into us by the system that is sort of corruptive.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we're sort of looping back to Ain't I a Woman? Here's this whole history that's laid out of actual abuse, psychological and physical, and how it was much worse for Black women historically under slavery, even than Black men, right? They were constantly raped. They had even sort of a lower social status. They were given the heavy work that the Black men laborers were given, as well as work that the Black men would consider too demeaning. They were sort of subject to everything. And that a lot of this continued, and she goes through the history of kind of how they were treated at various points in terms of their admittance to the workforce and under what conditions. And at the same time, she gives these myths, and some of these myths I wasn't even really aware of, but like the myth of Black women don't need liberation. It's the white women, they were the ones who were sort of coddled, and they couldn't be let out in the workforce, and they wanted to go out in the workforce, but Black women have always been forced out in the workforce, so they don't need that sort of liberation. Black men haven't put them on a pedestal and said, oh, you harmless little thing, I'll care for you and do every little thing for you and give you no political power. They've, in fact, led families, you know, been the primary breadwinner as a majority position for a good chunk of American history. This is the kind of myth that the patriarchy, the racist patriarchy, is putting upon, you know, and consequently she spends a lot of time talking about how this myth of the matriarchy is really what that is. That, yeah, Black women were the heads of their household, and Black men, in fact, felt emasculated from that, and that's why they desert their wives in such numbers, because the wives are all shrewish or something, you know. So there's all these horrible stereotypes that then the solution is to not only sort of go do this historical deconstruction that she's doing, but to develop a counter narrative. And so how do you develop a counter narrative? Well, it sounds like you should have a common shared experience, like what I was just saying, that Black women were screwed over uniformly throughout history. So that's the counter narrative. And so you could say, okay, the Black feminist groups at least can share this counter narrative, and they can use that to empower themselves, empower each other, and become independent. But I think that she wants to say that more than that, that would only be half of self-actualization, having the support of a group like that. But of course, becoming a whole person is becoming an individual. It's not being part of a group, is to grow in that unique way that every single one of us grows and love each other and our difference and all that. So I think those things are not incompatible. It's just a matter of sort of seeing they're both necessary components of self-actualization as she sees it.
So I don't know that she says this explicitly, but I think something that's undergirding her point of view is that you have to have a wide open field of opportunities for self-actualization. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what it means, if nobody tells you what being a mathematician is, you know, you never have the opportunity to explore that aspect of yourself. Again, I'm going to go back to this, that, you know, white men, or if you want to include Mediterranean style, basically European males who have benefited from ideology, you know, for the last several hundred or thousand, couple thousand years, and who benefit from colonialism and all that, being able to say, go want to be an artist or choose to study philosophy as opposed to mathematics or physics or whatever is a luxury of the empowered, the rich, the ones who don't stand to lose much by making that choice. But oppressed groups, and again, instead of generalizing, I'll specifically say here, she's talking about Black women, have not had the opportunity to explore all the different things that they might. And so there's just this barrier to self-actualization in the sense of you have to have the opportunity. You have to have the world open up to you. And that's why I think, yes, there's this self-overcoming. There's this self-realization. There's an acknowledgement of the role that we're all assigned inside of this paradigm and that we understand that we are in the paradigm, but you don't overcome it simply through an act of will. I feel like there's got to be more to it than that. Now, maybe that self-recognition is sufficient for you to go push to take opportunities that wouldn't otherwise have been given to you, but I don't know. I'm not tying the threads together very well here, but it just seems like out of every essay I read, there's this notion of if we're not working collectively to overcome and overthrow the imperialist, colonial, capitalist paradigm that restricts all of us, some more than others, then we're not really creating the space for people to truly self-actualize.
As I'm listening, I'm still trying to work out what I do indeed think that Hooks is saying. And what was just said, that sounds right to me. I'm still trying to put the pieces together. I mean, she doesn't really say, hey, I'm going to give an account of self-actualization. And I'm still pulling the pieces together.
Right. We just need to read another 5 books of hers and maybe we'll have.
Or she may come out with a book next week on self-actualization.
After she hears this, she'll definitely.
Yeah, she's going to listen to this. Next one.
Yeah. Let me throw another twist out here. You know, when people are trying to tell narratives about groups, and you can tell the stories of the people who stood up, who rebelled, who were knocked down, who took a stance, who argued in favor, who advocated, right? Those are people who are reacting against the paradigm, and they're sort of your revolutionary heroes, if you will, right? They're the controversial ones, the ones that your parents may not want you to idolize, like she mentions about Angela Davis. Then there's a whole host of stories about, I mean, there must be many Black women who got degrees, worked in jobs. They were mathematicians. They were scientists. They were business women, you know, people who don't have a revolutionary story to tell, but tell a story about, hey, they went, they decided they wanted to do something. They did it. They became a choreographer or a playwright or whatever. And one of the things that Bell Hooks doesn't do in any of the readings that we've done, and, you know, there's possible she does it elsewhere or whatever, is she's not talking about that type of person who can be a hero to a young girl or a young boy. You know, we all had people like that in our lives where we met and we met friends of our parents or somebody who came into our school is like, oh, and this is my job. I do this, or I launch rockets for NASA or whatever. And you're like, wow, that's really cool, right? She's definitely playing on the extremes of the narrative structure. And it's an important point because it's difficult to reconcile her discussion about self-actualization, all that, when the examples she's using are women who are reacting strongly against the paradigm and being punished for it. Because all the examples that she uses are women who struggled mightily against oppressive regimes and in many cases suffered for it.
Okay, so I'm a little confused right now. Are you contrasting the struggling against racism or sexism, but then suffering against it within her own peer group? Going back to the story that Bell Hooks tells of uncomfortableness with diversity and having been given the cold shoulder at a Black feminist conference for having brought up something that disagreed with another participant? That's the suffering?
No. So I'm talking when she's talking about Angela Davis, and the other examples she brings up are all exceptional women whose the cause that they took up was to fight against the oppression. But there may very well have been a number of women who self-actualized in very normal, boring professions, who suffered sexism and racism in their jobs, but who weren't necessarily figureheads that then were marginalized because of their taking a stance against oppression. And so my question is, because that's not an example of self-actualization that she gives, I don't know whether that counts or doesn't count in her framework and how that contributes to that overall revolutionary theme that I mentioned earlier.
There's one of the essays that's a little later in the Black Looks book that's about the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings.
Oh, really? Oh, really?
Why didn't we read that one, Mark? Listen.
We should have read that.
You didn't even bring it up, man.
Yeah, the movie was last week.
Yeah.
Confirmation on HBO.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Hey, was there a Kerry Washington too, right? Kerry Washington?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Was there any controversy about her playing Anita Hill? Because of her skin tone and looks or anything? But
no.
It was about Zoe Saldana playing Nina Simone.
Nina Simone.
But Zoe's totally the opposite of the spectrum when it comes to Nina Simone.
Yeah, she does. She looks very different than Nina Simone does.
I know, but okay.
So the thing with the Anita Hill was talking about how dispiriting it was for people that were trying to think we could do something about sexual harassment, and how Clarence Thomas kind of played the, you're all setting out on a lynching on me. So like pulling that card out to then negate the feminist. So this is sort of, it is related to what we're talking about, it just in that she thinks that sometimes the racism thing sort of overwhelms the feminism thing, that it obscures the feminism thing, that feminism is a legitimate struggle that people should be enlightened to. And yet too many black women feel like they need to be in solidarity with black men, no matter how dickish the black men, overbearing the black men are being. Sort of as a postscript, she says about Anita Hill, look, this is an example of a professional black woman who's in, you know, these, but she's a Republican. She was not engaged in any kind of, her struggle was not connected to any kind of liberation movement. And she uses this as a point for criticizing Anita Hill, that no, she does not count as one of the feminist heroes just because she played the masculine game, the game of the establishment, to the degree that she did. You know, that she succeeded professionally. So I'm sure she'd have the same thing to say about Condoleezza Rice or, you know, any other, at least black women Republicans.
I wonder if she's updated that essay since, because history, I mean, I was very young when the case happened, right? So my consciousness wasn't that great. But what I hear is that it was pretty, you know, most women were for Clarence, but there were lots of women who was for Anita. And now that I'm older and I saw a documentary of her that was released a couple of years ago, it was made clear to me that she had lots of support by black feminists. I mean, Barbara Ramsey, who teaches in the History and Women's Studies Department at the University of Illinois Chicago, was the one responsible for taking out an advertisement in the New York Times supporting her. And I've talked to older, you know, black feminists who basically said they used to wear t-shirts as "We Believe Anita." But I also wonder, I mean, there's times in which when we write about contemporary moments, our views are sometimes shaken up by the time and the climate of the time, and it's probably not well thought of. And I think that people who were against Anita, I think their consciousness have grown to the point, I mean, they probably was also ensnared by the lynching language of Clarence Thomas. And it seems also, her criticism in the article seems to go against a lot of what she writes in Ain't I a Woman about taking the struggle of black men becomes a struggle for all, you know, for all people. And so we tend to side and fight for the rights of black men at the expense of black women.
Yeah, that's exactly what she's saying what happened here.
Yeah. But even her notion of Anita not being that kind of icon, I just historically, I think, you know, the icon that Anita Hill is has just risen in the last 10 years or so. That's quite different from the way that it was in the early 90s. So that's why I said, would she change that? I think Anita is viewed quite differently than the way that Hooks is describing her in the 90s.
Well, I also just think that this reflects Hooks' type of criticism, that it could be that you just, wow, she's like Adorno. She's just going to spit on everything. There's just always something wrong. You never do it right. But I think it's just a matter of, again, the criticism supposedly coming from a place of love and respect, such that, yeah, of course she was in favor of Anita Hill against her harasser. but she just thought the whole thing was just still everybody involved was Republicans, and all the senators that were judging were white men. And so it was a people playing, a black man and a black woman playing within this system, you know, that had fundamentally bought into a corrupt system. So nobody's the good guy in there, but there are worse villains than others in there. And certainly Anita was the best of them, if that's how the criticism would go.
Hey, before we talk more about bell hooks, I want to stop and talk about our sponsor, The Great Courses. Lifelong learners will appreciate The Great Courses' new video learning service, The Great Courses Plus, where you can learn about anything that interests you with unlimited access to thousands of The Great Courses lectures on fascinating topics taught by top professors. The Great Courses are giving our listeners an opportunity to watch their popular course, Redefining Reality, The Intellectual Implications of Modern Science, and hundreds of other courses absolutely free. Redefining Reality features award-winning professor Stephen Gimbel, examining how the evolution of science, psychology, and mathematics contribute to and change our concepts of reality. Now, the course has 36 lectures, and I just watched lecture 24, Race and Reality, and I think this half-hour lecture on race provides a really good complement to the kind of history that bell hooks gives us. I mean, first off, he actually explains why, evolutionarily, there are different skin colors, i.e. melatonin blocks UV rays. He talks about how Kant was a racist and white supremacist, and about the few hundred years after that, as scientists were investigating race, they were trying to find what basis is there, if any, in biology and psychology for race, how scientists have found that there's much more genetic variability within groups than across them. Only about 6% of the differences between individuals are accounted for by race. He talks about phrenology, about IQ tests, about the fundamental attribution error, which is how we generalize when an individual does something that we don't like. If it's somebody that we think is like us, then we say that is a jerk. If it's somebody that's part of an out-group, then we don't just say that person is a jerk as an individual. We make generalizations about the group. That's just a human psychological fact that we all do that. And he wraps up by talking about All in the Family and Martin Luther King. And though King thought we were sort of destined for social progress, is there any scientific basis for that optimistic belief? Anyway, very interesting. You can watch as many lectures in that and many other series as you want, anytime, anywhere. That course alone has a $335 value, and you can get it for a limited time for free when you go to thegreatcoursesplus, that is PLUS.com/PEL. So start watching today. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
Today's show is also sponsored by libertarianism.org. I spoke to the good people at libertarianism.org and took the opportunity to peruse their site, looking at some of the content they've got there. It's a really nice layout, and they have some very quality resources on libertarianism, which we've discussed in previous episodes, for example, our episode on Nozick. The folks there wanted me to let you know about libertarianism.org guides. Libertarianism.org guides are self-paced online courses taught by top professors and experts. They are completely free, and no sign-up of any kind is required. Now, the libertarianism.org guides introduce the basic ideas and principles of a free and flourishing society and serve as a path to further learning. The guides include an introduction to political philosophy featuring Jason Brennan, and an introduction to libertarianism featuring David Boas, with many more to come. If you'd like to explore libertarian ideas for a free and flourishing society, libertarianism.org guides will help you get your footing. You can find the libertarianism.org guides on libertarianism.org. Now back to the show.
She also, just to give the modern one, since you brought up Kerry Washington, was in that YouTube thing, she mentions Shonda Rhimes as, you know, declares herself a feminist. She's the one that produces Scandal and these other TV shows.
How to Get Away with Murder and Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, exactly. How to Get Away with Murder. So these are things that, like, wow, you put Viola Davis on TV, this kind of strong black woman hero. Like, shouldn't this be exactly the kind of thing that bell hooks would be radically in favor of? But no, she thinks that, yes, maybe you have, sure, that's good that you have that kind of person as a lead, and that she does things in the show. I've watched this with my wife where she, like, you know, takes off her wig and sort of shows her natural side, and it just is giving a model that definitely has not been out there before. But at the same time, bell hooks just thinks, you know, just sort of in a blanket way says that all those shows that she's involved with, Shonda Rhimes is involved with, are just spewing out this horribly sexist stuff. I don't want to get into the particulars, but I think there's a case that could be made for that. Definitely.
So she accuses Shonda Rhimes of being a bandwagon feminist.
Exactly. Yeah, that people declare that it's now kind of trendy to declare yourself a feminist, but you're not being the right kind of feminist.
But I think this also goes against what we've read from her, right? As far as difference is concerned. That not all women have the same narratives. And not, you know, women work out their self-actualization in very different ways. And to see, for example, those two characters work out their self-actualization two different ways is informative. And I think it helps us to see that Black women are not monolithic.
I watched the same thing that Mark did. And she does, it's not even apply. She basically, she's clear that not all self-actualization is equivalently authentic, which I agree seems to be at odds with what we read in Ain't I a Woman. And the examples she gives are, not everything that you do can be, just because you say, I'm choosing to do it, means that you are acting out your self-actualization.
That you are really acting freely, yeah.
Yeah, you're not acting freely. Just because you're not acting freely. And there's a lot more to say about that, but that's basically her critique, that not every action is a free action.
And then my response would be, well, how do you judge the authentic ones from the inauthentic ones?
That's a good question.
Or should we be in the business of doing that? I don't know.
She didn't give this example. She gave examples of being in popular culture and being very, very sexually provocative and stuff like that. But a good contemporary example would be women who insist on their right to wear a burqa. You know, the criticism of that is that they're participating in their own oppression, and they've been oppressed so much that they're willing to side with their oppressors in this way. Or, you know, the women who participate in genital mutilation, stuff like that. So, well, these women are doing that. How can it possibly be that they're oppressed?
Or being sex positive, you know, dressing really provocatively because it's for me, because I want to. No, she's going to say, you've internalized oppressor norms. You're not, that's not a free choice.
Yes, that's exactly what she'll say. It's not a free choice. You are not self-actualized in doing that. In fact, you are actually acting as a slave. That's what she would say.
And then I'll ask,
sure.
Well, how are we able to decipher which one is, you know, the authentic one from the one that's inauthentic? And
I think it would just be only through sustained engagement, looking at yourself and being able to talk openly and have that safe communication space. And so that is where you would need the, not just a supportive social group, but sort of spiritual leaders who are ahead of you on the path. Assuming you can figure out who such a person is.
Yeah. But it seems like a cultural critic wouldn't have that insight. I mean, yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, in light of her criticism, if indeed she's judging something to be, I don't know if she was directly judging or at least giving us our attention to something that may be inauthentic. What is the criteria or the necessary and sufficient condition for that to be inauthentic? And who has the power or at least the access to figuring out which is which?
It makes me want to listen to your pornography episode on your podcast, because I'm sure you talk about this kind of question, which is, for people, being a woman participating in pornography, is she engaging in that in a free way? Or is it simply part of being patriarchal, oppressed culture? That's one version of the question. Another one was the burqa. You can pick any number of these questions where, on the one hand, it seems very difficult to talk about how are you to judge whether it's a self-actualization or not. But in a lot of the cases, it seems hard not to say, at the very least, it's really dicey.
First off,
yeah,
we're talking about it from a position of judgment. Like, okay, well, what right do we have to make any kind of judgment anyway? Particularly, we're talking about her making judgments after she felt judged by other people.
Sure.
Or if we judge, what is the criteria for that judgment?
Right. But then the second thing is, anytime you hear anybody saying the word authenticity,
yes,
make sure you got a good, strong grip on your wallet. Because...
And I noticed I didn't see that in Bell Hooks anywhere. That
she's not holding her wallet?
So
no. Authenticity.
And that, she doesn't talk about authenticity per se, but I
she
mean,
doesn't?
We've kind of brought that up.
Really?
But yes, it's very dangerous when somebody starts trying to talk about other people's authenticity or lack thereof.
Well, isn't that self-actualization?
Take it from a guy who wrote a master's thesis on Heidegger.
Okay. I'm all in favor of holding onto my wallet in that respect, but doesn't self-actualization have, like, run in the same lane as authenticity?
Does she even use that term, or did I inject that here too?
I thought that she
at least uses truth. She says people like hearing truth. This is her describing her own work. She sees her criticisms, whether, you know, media critiques or historical critiques or whatever, as speaking truth, and people can hear that. So it's not merely her opinion.
But what's the phrase that she uses to describe raising one's own consciousness? I thought it was self-actualization, but maybe it was you, Mark.
You know, I don't feel like we have sufficiently, at least critically, brought up her main point in AI Woman, which is that you shouldn't talk about racism and sexism as sort of being different kinds of oppression, that in a strong way, it's just a singular, at least for a black woman, it's a singular experience of being oppressed. And yeah. to focus on one of those sort of necessarily excludes paying proper attention to the other. And so this needs sort of a special treatment, that we've had a black liberation movement and we've had a women's liberation movement. But because black women have both of those, they're actually not fully covered by each of those movements. And so we need at least a black woman consciousness raising, but then in keeping with what Seth was saying, also like an actual liberation movement to make concrete political changes, not merely raise the consciousness of the individuals involved.
Yeah, when I was reading the essays, I was putting intersectionality into the margins. And I don't think this term probably, when did Hooks write "An AI Woman"?
Came out in 82.
Yeah, that's too early. Yeah. So that's kind of before the term itself, intersectionality, came into being.
Tell us what that really means.
So it's kind of like the intersection. So kind of by multiple identities, they all have effect in the way in which we're treated. And so I can be a black man and experience a kind of oppression, but I can be a black woman and experience a different kind of oppression, right? It's because the identities of my womanness and my African-Americanness has intersected. And so I think this was one of the criticism of the white feminist movement, is that, hey, all women are the same. You go back to this notion of difference. We experience the same thing, right? Because we're just women. And black women were saying, yeah, we experience the same, quote unquote, as women, but our experience as women take on kind of a different feature than your experiences as women. And it's not necessarily an oppression Olympics that I experience worse than you, but it's getting people to see the kinds of oppression that can occur when one's identities kind of intersect. And it was interesting to see the historical thing that she was giving us from Anna Julia Cooper. I mean, these feminists in the 19th century knew that they face different, you know, a multitude of oppressions based on their identities. And historically, how bell hooks lays it out, it seems that black men were totally oblivious. And it seemed that white women was totally oblivious. And I agree with you, what bell hooks is trying to get us to see, that there's a different, first of all, stop excluding black women from getting liberation, but also taking consideration that they experience oppression, but also a different kind of oppression than we would like to imagine, and that ought to be given uptake.
And so this is very clear in the historical examples that she gives of fighting for the vote, say, or fighting for getting into certain job areas. Is this still relevant? Obviously, the intersectionality is talked about a lot. So how does this fit into this, again, the crisis of feminism or the crisis of race liberation movements or whatever that I was referring to earlier that she talks about, that, you know, once you get to a certain, we've achieved something, so therefore the problem is solved. No,
problem isn't solved. As I was reading the essays, I couldn't help but think about Black Lives Matter.
Yep.
And one of the criticisms of Black, although it was started by two Black lesbian women, the narrative of police brutality against Blacks was constructed around this narrative that Blacks really meant Black boys and Black men, and women were being excluded from the conversation. And it wasn't until, you know, you have your Sandra Blands and you have your Rakia Boyds, but it's Black feminists who, you know, hence the hashtag Say Her Name, is trying to bring these Black women into the conversation. And that's an ongoing effort. But the very beginning of Black Lives Matter, and even with still some people today, Black women were being erased from the narrative, that they too, you know, have been oppressed by the police in very different ways, but also in very similar ways. So I see that still going on in Black liberation today. And, you know, and like I said before, ideology is a hell of a drug, but also patriarchy is also a hell of a drug. And this notion that Black still means men, Black men, is very problematic. And it just shows that there's so much work to do to decolonize us all.
Well, and you can imagine if she was writing a few years later, or that then adding the sexual orientation thing to the
the lair, you know, you were just saying that it was two black lesbians started the movement. Is that what you just said?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So more intersectionality.
Yeah. Which makes it strange that two black women, you know, create the movement, but are not discussed at all. And the killings that are taking place, you know, it's all black men, which is just ironic. And for a lot of people, it was deja vu. It's kind of like, if you were conscious at all, you were able to see through it. And there's a story that was told to me by a black feminist who, when the Trayvon Martin thing happened, I think they was at a protest of some sorts. And it was the brother of a young lady who had gotten killed before by the police. He was encouraged at this particular rally to only talk about Trayvon Martin, to not bring up his sister. I mean, how can you tell a young man not to bring up his sister? And it just goes to show that the rhetoric that they felt that needed to be articulated in that moment was to talk about the death of black men, as if discussing black women would distract from the aims of the movement, which is, I think, exactly what bell hooks is trying to get us to see, that it's not a distraction. There's more than one narrative, and that adds to what we're doing for liberation.
Well, I just wanted to confirm. So there was a speaker for this, and he was encouraged by the organizers of the event not to talk about his sister who had been killed by the police. Just seems so weird. But it's, of course, exactly in coordination with bell hooks wrote 30 years ago.
Bell hooks has blown your mind. That's exactly what she wanted to do. I just looked up the phrase Oppression Olympics. It was coined by feminist author and activist Elizabeth Batita Martinez in 1993 to challenge the idea of the hierarchy of oppressions when addressing inequalities faced by minorities. So there you go.
Well, if you go to the Black Lives Matter website and you go to the About page, one of the tabs in the About page is her story, to talk about the founders of it.
Well, there you go. I want to talk a little bit more about how important is it to have unified messaging. I think that one of the things that bell hooks is trying to accomplish is to say self-actualization, whether she uses that word or not. The thing that we're all pushing for, not just individually, but as a society, should allow for, as you were saying, Aisha, multiple narratives. And yes, there's a lot to say about sort of which ones deserve to be turned into a political movement, to have political actions based on them, which ones are the most pressing, which ones reflect the most injustice. But still, you could be able to say all those things. The fact that we live in sort of a soundbite world, and this is a main target of, if we want to connect bell hooks' criticism of the media back to like Adorno's criticism of the media or other Marxist kind of criticisms of the media, is, of course, any criticisms of the media, it's all about oversimplifying and making things bite-sized. And that goes very much in line with, no, there has to be one consistent narrative. So I think the thing that might bug me about, as I was describing at the beginning, the kind of the lesser writers that were influenced by bell hooks and are maybe trying to challenge bell hooks, but are not doing anywhere near as good a job, is because they are violating this thing that she is pointing out of, no, you don't have to stay on message every second. You can tell multiple narratives. You don't have to have every story be addressing the most pressing social issue, so long as all the stories that are told do not serve to just obscure or block out other narratives. I think it's maybe just a matter of probably saying it that way does not address the practical problems that come up in a given circumstance. You know, if you're at a particular rally and you're trying to get people to pass the Trayvon Martin law, like, you know.
I think her criticism is more sharp-edged than that. I think that she was, that there ought to be a big tent, but that the staying on message rhetoric to suppress other opinions is really the activity of a sexist, oppressive society.
Yeah.
It's an oppressive action masquerading as a tactical decision.
Yeah. No, I like that, that it's just, it's buying into the thing that they're supposed to be rebelling against.
Yeah. And it goes, so it goes right to the heart of her equating the kind of activity that's happening in racism and sexism. And it becomes clear when you have patriarchal activity among black men and you have racist activity among white women. That's why they have they're both talking about being oppressed, but they're also both oppressing, even in their rhetoric and even in their organization.
Any other main points from the books that we haven't hit that people want to throw out there before we move toward completion?
The only thing we didn't really get into and I don't know how much energy I have for it right now, but was we didn't talk so much about the representations of whiteness chapter 11, and the gist being that this kind of is in line with the, you know, loving blackness, that there's a way in which white is represented as good and black is represented as bad, and that whiteness with respect to white people is associated with positive images and blackness as negative images. And I can't say that I took anything strong away from that chapter in the book, other than, again, and I know I'm sounding like a broken record tonight, but that it's not a theoretical thing to uncover and recognize how language and metaphors and all that work against to reinforce this ideology. And this is kind of like your Frozen example, that as I was reading this, I was thinking, how would I go about erasing what I assume? I'm going to assume that when she says, for example, that you can be, you know, not prejudiced, but still be perpetuating the dominant ideology, right? I'm a good white liberal. Like, I try not to be racist. I try not to be sexist, but I'm sure that I think and do things that perpetuate those things. So if I was going to try to erase this, it's not simply a theoretical exercise where I'd be like, you know what, I'm going to examine what are the adjectives and things that I associate with whiteness and blackness. I think I would literally have to go out in my life and try to actively flip the tables and any assumptions, try to recognize what assumptions I have when I meet somebody for the first time based on how they look, their gender, their race, you know, what I find out about their sexual orientation, and flip everything on its head and try to actively erase those, not simply through an act of cognition, but in practice. So I thought that was a tremendous challenge. Now, in this chapter, she's talking about how white people don't know that black people have this really negative idea about whiteness, and that what we think of, we're just like, oh, you know, do-de-do-do-do. But in the meantime, through their own experience, that black people have a very different recognition.
Even if they don't realize it.
Yeah.
Is part of what, that even if the particular black person says, I'm not afraid of white people or whatever, she still thinks this is sort of part of a possible false consciousness. To name that whiteness in the black imagination is often a representation of terror.
Terrorism, right. And again, this is not something that I can overcome by myself. That my feeling is that the call to action in this was to actively cultivate and meet and interact with people, with black men and women. And that's the only way that I will have the opportunity to see a different perspective and to have the opportunity to maybe eventually erase that default ideology from my brain. And I take that very seriously. You know, one of the things that I think about and I talk about with people here in Austin quite a bit is that, you know, what diversity I have with respect to race and in my sphere of friends here in Austin is pretty limited. Like, most of the black people I know like through the internet, right? And most of them seem to be philosophy teachers and professors or of various sorts. And it strikes me that I've got a paucity. My takeaway from all this is that I have a real poverty of experience based on who I know and who I spend time with, and that it's impoverished not only my view of the world and other people's experiences, but also potentially made me more of an agent to perpetuate harmful ideology, and that I need to do something to rectify that.
Yeah, it seems that, and I'm just going to quote a line from her in the end of that essay. She says, as critical intervention, it allows for the recognition that progressive white people who are anti-racist might be able to understand the way in which their cultural practice reinscribes white supremacy without promoting paralyzing guilt or denial. And of course, she talks about empathy before that. So, I'm thinking that if I was a white person, what can I now do? I mean, I can empathize and imagine if I was in the shoes of a black person, what would they think of me? But it seems as if Hooks is also suggesting that we can at least change cultural practice. Now, exactly what cultural practices is, don't quite know. But changing whatever we may think cultural practice to be can be done not only directly, but indirectly. And so I just wonder, in our interactions with other people, you know, in which ways can our cultural practice not perpetuate racism? And I don't necessarily think that it has to be done directly towards a black person. I think even in social settings or academic settings, whatever those settings are, our interactions with other people. Yeah, I think cultural practice as a whole can have an impact. And so we can begin to change those, even if it's not directly directed towards a person of color.
So I'm guessing that bell hooks would not approve of my current strategy of being an equal opportunity misanthrope.
I suspect not.
Explain.
Would I cross the street if a black person is there? Yes, but I also would cross the street if a little old white lady is there. I cross the street from everyone. I okay. fear all people.
No, you just dislike them all.
Thank you for putting up with our stumbling around through this, Maisha.
No, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it. I appreciate the experience.
And I hope, I know Law wanted us to do this because he was going to be teaching some bell hooks. And so this was like his way of prepping. And even though he didn't get to be on the episode, he read the stuff. So he was all ready. Things came up. So thanks to him. Thanks to you. Seth and Dylan, you guys have any other closing type thoughts? You can keep going, Seth. We like hearing from you. You can pull it out at the end.
People subscribe only because of you, Seth.
Well,
you know.
Yeah. So a couple of things. First off, I'd like to reiterate. So there's a common theme on this podcast that we talk about how bad philosophers can be as writers sometimes.
Yes.
And so we are happy to read good writers and good writing. And she is certainly an excellent writer. And when I mean that, not just because the prose is clear, but she's the line of thought and the argumentation is very clear and the points. Just, it's very easy to follow the flow of the point she's trying to make, and she makes them very forcefully without being polemical or anything like that. She's a really, really good writer.
She does have a book on writing.
Does she?
Which will blow your mind. You would never look at writing the same.
So the second aspect that I thought was interesting, like again, I mentioned, was the complete lack of discussion of religion. She talks about in Ain't I a Woman about the Victorian notion of chastity and purity of woman versus the base aggressive sexual nature of man, but that was only applied to white women. You know, there's a lot of complexities to her analysis, but that notion of woman as ideal and as pure is something that definitely comes out of a Western, specifically Judeo-Christian, Islamic as well. I'm not sure, but, and so I'm surprised that that didn't figure more in her analysis. And I know if Law were here, you know, that would have been a much greater topic of conversation, not just because of his profession and avocation, but because when we've talked about civil rights and black liberation movements, when we read MLK and W.E.B. Du Bois and all that, was that the interconnectedness, the critical role that Christianity and the church played in 20th century black emancipation movement and the civil rights movement. And so it's interesting. And it made me think when I was reading her, we were reading one of the essays and she mentioned about teaching at Yale, I think. And it made me think of Cornel West, who we've also read for this podcast. And in fact, what was the name of the book we read? Do you remember, Mark and Dylan?
Race Matters, Democracy Matters.
We read parts of Race Matters, but we also read it. There's an essay where he talks about, Prophesied Deliverance.
Okay.
And it's for him, obviously, too, it's critical. So that's an interesting disparity. And I wonder if bell hooks has ever had a recorded debate, or whether in print or in audio or video, with Cornel West. So I'd be very interested in pursuing that.
I think there is a conversation between the two. It should be on YouTube. I hope I'm not mixing bell hooks up with Toni Morrison, but I think they are.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it, but okay. I saw that there is.
So I'm going to check that out. Anyway, we always end these things and I always try to give a recommendation whether I think anybody should read this stuff or not. And this is definitely gets my endorsement. And I was thinking about going and actually ordering a copy of the Black Looks book just to get a physical copy so I could read the other essays that are in it. And I'll definitely be following up with her. So I really appreciated the topic and appreciate you coming on, Maisha, to chat with us.
Well, thank you. And the book is called Remembered Rapture.
Okay.
Doesn't sound like a book on writing, but it is. And it would totally change your perspective about writing.
Thank you.
Cool.
Well, I enjoyed all of her writing, but I think the Ain't I a Woman was the least pleasant of the things that I read by her, just because it was so much of the same thing for so long. And maybe it was because you guys didn't read the first two chapters.
I did.
But she's just like, I was just going on trying to find like, what are the, okay. So everybody read the entire book.
Yeah. The first two chapters are really good.
I think also Ain't I a Woman, and it's interesting that you gave us the history of it. The chapters were kind of long for Bell Hooks chapters. And I was wondering, this is different. This is odd. You said this was her first book, and this was something that she... Yeah, I think it's an outlier case of how her chapters usually go. So I was surprised by it.
But a seemingly deep well of interesting stuff. Even if you don't agree with her take on Madonna, or she weighs in on a lot of stuff. She has an essay on Tina Turner, right after the ones we read in Black Looks. So you can take into that. She's not happy with Tina Turner trying to put a positive spin in our biography on being abused and taking control of her sexuality, and by adopting the persona that she did, the vamp persona that she did. She was internalizing. She was being the wrong kind of feminist.
I'm going to read that.
Diversity of opinion.
Well, but I guess this is the kind of thing that it could, like, if I just read an article like that criticizing Tina Turner in Salon, I would probably be annoyed. But because I like her writing, then I'm not annoyed. I just thought it was an enjoyable read. So,
yeah, I have a special kind of difficulty listening to academic criticisms of artists.
Yeah.
Because I think the act of creation, especially the act of artistic creation and performance, is itself revolutionary in some way. And also it's a social act. It's a revolutionary act. It's an act of defiance against social norms in some respects. And it bothers me, you know, like, you can't criticize Tina Turner. And
she is a critic, right? That's part of the gig.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, next time we're going to do some Simone de Beauvoir. The Ethics of Ambiguity is the book. So pick that up. And you might want to check out the blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com. Maybe people will have some discussion about this episode. Maybe on our Facebook group, we'll have some discussion about this episode. If you become a subscriber and are able to get behind the scenes, you could have a not school group on this episode. On other Bell Hooks books, other things that you think, why didn't you read that? If you're going to talk about Bell Hooks, you should talk about this other author that is definitely better than Bell Hooks, of talking about the same thing. Why didn't you read that? You could propose that as a non-school group, and you could have a discussion in that voice that I just did.
Thank you again to our sponsor, Libertarianism.org. Libertarianism.org has hundreds of informative resources to learn about the theories, histories, and principles of free societies. There are podcasts, videos, free books, classic reprints, and insights from experts past and present. Learn more about free and open societies at libertarianism.org.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Better drunk than lonely. Better burnt than cold. Better out of mind than out of time. Better young than old. Please be warm and merry. Please don't sit and rot. Please reject this lecture. Become what you are not. Live for this moment. Live for the next as well. Live and make good stories. Tell the mama run. Than boring, better loose than tight, better lost than stuck at home, better love than all alone. Live for this moment, live for the next as well. Stories make them run like hell. See the good in life. get stories that your kids can tell.